Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, producer picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during the previous week. On today's show, we'll hear segments from all three episodes that aired this week, starting with
talking to some of the residents, including some of the descendants of Black Wall Street. There's such a need and importance for this to be remembered. A lot of people see Tulsa as kind of like a Buffalo, where there's so much potential in our city, but we need to also embrace the history that comes with that potential.
Monday's episode with Dr. Barbara Seals Nevergold, Lauren Costner, and Tala Hardin. Three individuals who worked closely with the documentary A Shot Rang Out. We'll then move to
and we believe strongly in the fundamental dignity of each person and guest as a way of recognizing them and also demonstrating the hospitality that we really prioritize when we interact with our guests.
Tuesday's episode with Mark Batesholt and Martha Lamage of Heart, Love, and Soul. And we'll close with
so we just took that approach, and that's what I basically came up with in my course. I'm just getting people the bare minimum, two cards and two loans, and that get them a jump start way better than what they ever knew.
Wednesday's first conversation with Justin Hawkins, a credit literacy educator. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit Jay Moran and Akua Menz-Adu's conversation about A Shot Rang Out, a documentary that dives into the historical context of the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921. They're joined by three individuals who discuss the connection that Buffalo has to the historic event: Dr. Barbara Seals Nevergold, Lauren Costner, and Tala Hardin.
And so, Dr. Nevergold, you started to talk about just the connection to history, but then also with the story, right? And when we think about Andrew Smitherman, there was something in the documentary that mentioned like three things that he wanted people to connect to, right? And that was the first one was just about the compassion, you know, having compassion for people who were displaced because of it. Also talking about some of the guilt that existed after as well. And I think the last one was just maybe a connection, a deeper connection, or?
Well, it had to do with a particular anti-lynching bill.
Okay.
The federal anti-lynching bill.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about that piece?
Yeah. When he was in Boston shortly after the massacre, somewhere in December or so of 1921, he wrote this extensive article talking about the massacre, and I wish at this point I had the title of it, but it's not here. But at any rate, he wrote this article, and he talked about the purpose of the article, and as you said, one was to kind of expose the guilt, of those who had burned and killed actually many people during that massacre. He talked about wanting to make sure that that people understood and were compassionate and, in a sense, were ready to give reparations to the individuals who were displaced because of the massacre, because, again, many had lost everything. And so he thought that there should be funds that were accumulated for them. And then the third thing, I think, that I talked about was that there was a federal bill that was proposed, the Dyer bill, and that was not passed until 2023, the Emmett Till anti-lynching bill. So you brought up Emmett Till earlier. So again, you know, here we are coming in kind of a circle back to Tulsa and back to Mr. Smitherman and his thinking. But those were the things that he wanted to impress the world about, not just the community of Tulsa or the state of Oklahoma or the country. He thought this was really a global issue.
Yeah,
Tala, let's talk about producing a documentary. I mean, this is It's got to be, I mean, a painstaking and very long and probably a process, and one that takes a lot of passion and a lot of commitment. Just take us through how it all came about, and, you know, maybe take us through a couple of those points where we're like, why am I doing this? No, just kidding.
Oh, yeah. No, right, I mean, definitely. I think anybody who like sits down and edits a project kind of gets through that, especially when it's a longer project and you're spending hours getting only like a couple of seconds done. But it's just, there have been so many stories that have been, I don't want to say lost to history, but just kind of like a little bit faded out of the way. And reading about this one just, I mean, it's just the tip of the iceberg with so many stories that are going to follow this. I've had a lot of inspiration along the way from other people, a lot of elders in the community just encouraging us to hold on to this history, learn about it, embrace it. And the way that I like to do things, like I said, is through film. The process started off, like I said, it was just supposed to be a quick social media video. But then the interview that I did with Dr. Nevergold, it was so good that it was one of those things that I kept digging. I kept wanting to learn more. And the more I found out, the more I was like, there's got to be more added to this. So it's going to be like, you know, 15-minute piece, 20-minute piece. And now it's almost 30 minutes. And there's still going to be more added into it. But the process was basically the interview with Dr. Nevergold. I sat down. I listened to it a few times. I took certain pieces of the story that I thought would really tie together. And then the thought and opportunity came up to go to Tulsa. And when I was there, it really became about memorializing the history that's down there. Talking to some of the residents, including some of the descendants of Black Wall Street, there's such a need and importance for this to be remembered. A lot of people see Tulsa as kind of like a Buffalo, where there's so much potential in our city, but we need to also embrace the history that comes with that potential. So when I was down there, I took the time to really listen and understand the ground, and then walking the path of where Black Wall Street was and seeing the destruction, seeing some of the bricks that are still left over from the massacre itself, just, it hit. I would say there is kind of like a spiritual nature on that ground too. Like there's so much power still that's left behind there. The art that's down there too, the murals that they have done, they just speak so loudly of Black excellence and the power that it took to try and destroy that. It was not destroyed. Black excellence is still here, but there were so many efforts to destroy that. And I think it's happening again. As soon as we find something that's powerful and natural, we want to destroy it. We don't amplify the greatness that comes with certain people. We want to just hush that down. So this documentary was a process to make sure that Andrew Smitherman is not forgotten to history, to make sure that the Tulsa Race Massacre is not forgotten to history, and that Black excellence survives and is resilient through time and time again. So that was the main goal in the process of that, is making sure that every single second that's poured into this documentary is about memorializing the excellence that came with Black Wall Street.
And there were so many nuggets in the documentary, too, because I think one of the last quotes came from William Trotter, right?
Yes.
Who also had a connection to the area in terms of the Niagara Movement,
yes,
right? And the
right.
connection there as well. Mm-hmm. And so folks don't understand where, you know, the Niagara Movement that then led to the NAACP all started right in our backyard, mm-hmm. right? And so can we just maybe talk a little bit about that connection and, you know, how I think Andrew Smitherman and William Trotter, they knew each other, obviously, back
yes.
then as well.
Yes. Well, you know, we had an exposition in Buffalo in 1901, the Pan American Exposition. And at that time, in terms of the African Americans, I mean, the whole premise of the Pan Am was to talk about all of the accomplishments and the achievements and the modernization that was occurring in the country and in the world. But when it came to the African Americans, the only exhibits that were going to be at the fair were the Old Plantation and Darkest Africa, stereotypic at best. And a group of Black women, the Phyllis Wheatley Club, held a protest rally to bring the Negro exhibit to Buffalo, which, you know, then expressed all of the accomplishments that Blacks had made since emancipation 30 years previously. Who created that exhibit? W.E.B. Du Bois. Mm-hmm. All right. So I made the connection that Du Bois, knowing Buffalo, knowing the sentiment and the advocacy of people in Buffalo for their rights, reached out to Buffalonians, to Mary B. Talbert and her husband, William, when he was thinking of setting up the Niagara Movement and was looking for a place to meet. And you know, there is information that that occurred and that the first meeting of the Niagara Movement occurred at Mary Talbert's home. Now, one thing I want to make clear is my friend, Dr. Lillian Williams, and I, you know, continue to sound the bell that Mary Talbert was not a member of the Niagara Movement in 1905 because they didn't allow women at all.
Yeah.
And William Trotter was one of those men, 29 men that came to Western New York, to Buffalo, and then they went over to Fort Erie, Canada, where they established the Declaration you know, of Rights proposed by the Niagara Movement. So again, the connections are there. We have to work some time to uncover them and to document them, but the connections are there because it was a relatively small group of people, you know, who were in the struggle. And they needed to work together and collaborate in order to bring power and strength to what they were doing.
I'm going to open this up and I'll let anybody who wants to take this, because it's a kind of one of these general questions, but I think it's an important question. And I think with three people who have are so steeped in, and invested in history, I think it might be a chance to explore this a little bit. I would suggest that in the country right now, our country, that there maybe is a little bit of a pushback against certain history and the certain history of specific people. And I'm wondering if A, you see that, and B, how you think this, again, we can only speculate to a certain extent, but if, you know, how this might affect the country and perhaps maybe what an individual can do to perhaps make sure that history isn't forgotten. Who wants to take that one? I know it's, and I know, like I said, all three of you, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
I'll say just acknowledging goes a long way, at least acknowledging that there is a problem, that there could be a solution, that we have to work towards it, and then being okay with being uncomfortable, because it's not going to last forever. Like, if we start to do the work now, it's not going to last forever. We're going to get to a point where it's going to be better. But a lot of the times, I think a lot of people are privileged with not having to deal with certain things every day. So that creates this narrative in their head that nothing is wrong. And then when someone comes in with a grievance, they're like, well, I'm sure it's not that bad. And then it starts to minimize the problem more and more. And it's not just with African-American people or with people of color in general. It's a day-to-day life thing. So just kind of acknowledging that we're not all going through the exact same thing. We're all going to go through things at different times. But also there is a problem that we need to acknowledge, and then we need to be uncomfortable while we're trying to create a solution.
Yeah, I think there's a misunderstanding, perhaps, that in order for one group to expound on its history requires another group to feel that their history is being put down and that they are being dishonored or somehow their history is being disavowed because looking at the history and telling the truth is difficult to hear. And you just have to point to the 1619 Project and the fact that that has engendered so much anger and pushback and belief that looking at the history and documenting the history from the perspective, not just the perspective of African Americans, but the perspective of the actual history, what happened. There's not an attempt to, you know, to, and I can't find the word at this point.
It's fine.
But, you know, my belief is that, yes, there is a pushback toward telling the truth about historical significant events, because there is a belief that if you do that, that demeans another group of people. So we have to work very hard, I think, at saying, no, that, you know, the history happened. There's no reason for you in 2024 to feel that you are less or you're embarrassed or you're being blamed for something that happened in 1619. But the truth is, this is the way people interacted. This is the result of that interaction that we call history.
I think that's a really good way to put it, because I think it's true. You know, you get defensive of, you know, your story and your history. So if you feel like another story is being told, it's hard not to maybe have a knee-jerk reaction. And I think as a museum, we do see that. And I think
you get like, that kind of feedback from patrons or
at times
observers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it makes me think of the Erie Canal exhibit that we're in the process of putting together, that Dr. Nevergold has been a part of too. And it's, I guess I see the museum just persisting. Like, we just have to keep that. The mission is there, and we just have to keep true to it. You know, it is our mission to include diverse perspectives. And so that is, you know, when that exhibit's up, you're going to see that. And we just have to stay committed to that mission.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so I know the story is really deep, and I think for some folks this might be their first time even hearing about the massacre at all. And so where can people find more information or maybe access this documentary?
It has not been fully published yet,
okay.
Mainly because there has been a lot of reach out from the family, so that gave me a second to kind of say, we can shape this a little bit more before it's fully published and ready to be on display. But as Dr. Nevergold brought up, that the anniversary is May 31st, I think probably having a screening which shows the full story around that time would be the best thing. And then after that, they'll be able to find it on, we'll make a website for it, and probably on YouTube, just like the general places. We haven't figured out just yet like how we're gonna actually like really push this out there, but I do think that a lot of schools have started to reach out. There have been other places that want us just to screen it and have conversations. I think that's the best way to start, kind of starting small and then working our way.
That was Dr. Barbara Seals Nevergold, Lauren Costner, and Tala Hardin, three individuals who have worked closely with A Shot Rang Out. We'll now shift over to a conversation with Mark Bateshold and Martha Lamage, the executive director and program director of Heart, Love, and Soul, a Niagara Falls nonprofit community-based organization that has provided services to the area since 1983. They sit down with Jay Moran to discuss some of the challenges that face the organization, which include limited staff and potential federal funding cuts. They also discuss the hope they have for the future and the positive impact that community support has on their organization.
Heart, Love, and Soul. What's Heart, Love, and Soul?
Yeah, so Heart, Love, and Soul is a community-based organization that's been around for 40-plus years in Niagara Falls. We're a food pantry, dining room. We have a number of different social services. Back in 2021, we created a new program called Daybreak that increased the scope of services that we can provide. And we've really focused on homelessness issues and provide case management. We have showers, laundry, haircuts, a foot clinic. We have a community health nurse. And another aspect of the Daybreak program is that it's a one-stop center. So we have a variety of agencies throughout the community who come in and provide services on site. And the idea there is that when you provide access to a range of services in one location, it means that more people are getting access to those services and can address their needs. So it's a growing organization and one that has served a vital role in the community.
Let's maybe talk about just Niagara Falls just to start here. Much of what we talk about on What's Next is generally focused on Buffalo. But I think when it comes to a lot of the demographics and things along those lines, especially when it comes to poverty, a very similar picture, I would think. What can you tell us about the reality of Niagara Falls?
Yeah, so I think it's been a community in decline for decades. Probably the last 50 or so years, I think the population has decreased significantly from maybe 100 to 150,000 back in its heyday to under 50,000 today. So many jobs have gone offshore, and the industrial base that drove the Niagara Falls economy is no longer there. And today, it's mainly a hospitality focused economy. Healthcare is another big part of the economy. But I think the reality is that the jobs that are available really don't pay living wages for a lot of people. And, you know, there's all kinds of issues that come with that. So we deal a lot with food insecurity. We deal with homelessness. So we see folks who are struggling to make ends meet or can't afford to pay rent. We see mental health issues. We see substance use issues. All of these things kind of compound, you know, each other and create a very difficult situation. And we do our best to try and provide services to meet people's needs.
And as you were talking, you did mention about, and it sounded, you mentioned kind of like a subset of the people that you deal with, in the sense that there are people you just aren't able to make ends meet. You're not making enough money. So it's not a matter of necessarily people being unemployed, but just not being able to stabilize to their families or their
sure.
current situation, right?
Yeah, I think people will ask us, you know, who do we serve? What's the demographic? What's the population that we serve? And that's a difficult question to answer because we serve a wide range of people. Mm-hmm. You know, we serve folks that have lived in the community for a long time, but are low income. We serve people who are unsheltered. We serve people who have disabilities. We serve elderly disabled folks from the Niagara Falls Housing Authority. We have a specific grant from HUD to provide services. One of those buildings is just two blocks from us.
Okay.
So we see a wide range of different people. I think the common uniting factor is that most of them are low income with limited means and, you know, challenging circumstances.
Yeah.
Hey, Martha, you run the Daybreak program,
yes.
Relatively new at Heart, Love, and Soul. Let's get into that just a little bit. What exactly is Daybreak?
So Daybreak is a one-stop shop social services program. And on that side, we provide immediate needs to guests that come in. So we have the services on site, which are showers. We have laundry services. We also have a computer room that's available to everyone in the community. Mm. We have nursing services. So we have a nurse on site. We also have our case management program, which also includes a community resource coordinator. And we have our one-stop center, which includes partners in the community of Niagara Falls that come on site to provide their services as well.
So you might, I mean, is there any kind of basic understanding of how many people you might be seeing in your program, whether on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis?
Ooh, it's...
I guess I'm wondering, does it fluctuate with some constant basis?
I think it fluctuates. Yeah. There's some moments where it seems very overwhelming, and there's some moments where it's steady. I would never say there's a moment where we're not seeing a lot, like a where it's more relaxed. It's always steady or just very busy. But I did actually look at some data yesterday, and last year, so 2024, I believe it was around, so not exactly,
sure.
We served 500 individuals. So, I mean, I think that number speaks volumes
right.
in how many people we see.
And it's interesting, and maybe both of you can get in on this a little bit, the term overwhelming. You know, you don't necessarily want to live in an overwhelming situation, but what really is it like? I mean, it's one thing for me to sit here and imagine what that is like, but what are you seeing in your program when you say that at times it can be overwhelming?
I think when it comes to, when I say overwhelming, there are a lot of people in the community that need help, and we have limited staff. We are trying our best to keep increasing our staff, whether it's on the hospitality side or the Daybreak program side, but there always seems to be more need than workers. So I think that's where the overwhelm and stress can sometimes come.
Yeah, I think, you know, Martha's kind of pointing to a structural problem in the nonprofit sector itself, right? There's an expectation, I think, that nonprofits provide services and that the individuals who provide those services should be mission-driven.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, both Martha and I have kids, we have families, we have, you know, the same day-to-day needs and responsibilities that everyone else has. And it's difficult to, you know, do what we do when we're constantly fighting an uphill battle for funding. You know, I think we've done a pretty good job. Heart, Love, and Soul has, you know, been a beacon in the community and a trusted institution for decades. So we benefit from that. We have a lot of donors who, you know, have been with us for a long time and really believe in our mission. But as we've grown, we've been, you know, seeing that the growth comes with these growing problems, and, you know, we do our best to address them. In terms of what the need looks like for our guests, I think people are really feeling desperate. And you can see that in more families who come. You can see it in the increasing food numbers. You can see it in the increasing use of our shower and laundry services. You know, the need has an impact, I think, on everyone.
Yeah.
Another thing that's happened over the last couple of years is that we've needed to add security as more people come in a, you know, a limited space and coming with a lot of burdens. You know, people are carrying trauma, people have mental health issues, people have substance use issues. And we had an increase in behavioral episodes that required, you know, more of a security presence. And that's a major cost to the organization as well. So, you know, I don't think what is happening at Heart and Soul is unique. I think that's been going on, you know, across the nonprofit sector. But it does create a lot of challenges for, you know, staff and our guests alike.
And I think, and you just used the term, and you, I believe Martha did as well, guest, very intentional use of the word here, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah.
So we use that term as a reflection of what we believe about the people we serve, right? I think, you know, we're an institution that comes out of the Catholic tradition and Catholic social teaching, and, you know, we believe strongly in the fundamental dignity of each person, and guest is a way of recognizing them and also demonstrating the hospitality that we really prioritize when we interact with our guests.
You seem to have a follow-up on that, or Martha?
No, I think he hit it on the nail. I agree 100%.
Yeah.
We want anyone that walks in the door to feel dignified, to feel respected, just to feel treated equally. So guest, I feel like calling them guest is a way of doing that. And they feel that when we call them guest instead of clients. So,
yeah. And just I'm hoping I'm not taking this on a tangent, but
no, we love tangents here.
Okay.
That's why we have this time.
Good. So the Daybreak program came out of a collaboration more than 10 years ago of a number of local nonprofits. And one of the things that was identified during that process of brainstorming and coming up with ideas and identifying problems was that the institutionalization of services is and can be demeaning, right? And it's not to walk into, say, a Department of Social Services building to fill out an application is not a wonderful experience, right? So we wanted to provide a built environment that is welcoming and inspiring. And one of the favorite questions, one of the favorite things that I get asked when I'm giving tours to people is if the Daybreak building was a former church, because we have a, you know, a trust system. It looks a little bit like a church, but it was not a church.
Okay.
But it was designed in a way to be uplifting and inspiring. And that's what, you know, we want our guests to feel when they come, that they're welcome, they're respected, this place is for them. We're going to uphold their dignity and treat them with respect, because the reality is, you know, in the world outside of Heart and Soul, it's often hard to find that dignity and,
sure,
and respect.
We're talking today about Heart, Love, and Soul out of Niagara Falls, and with us their executive director, Mark Batesold, and their program director, Martha Lamage. Let's talk about the guests, okay? I got to believe, I mean, Mark, you know, you know, if you were a development director and now you're the executive director, so you're probably dealing a lot of big picture things. And Martha, you've been in the organization for a few years and now with the Daybreak portion of it. But let's talk about the guests. I want to hear some stories about, who the guests are, what they say, what they're experiencing, whether on the high end or unfortunately maybe not necessarily all that glowing, I guess was the word to use.
Sure.
Talking about the guest, we serve a very diverse population. Yeah. So I think we get a little bit of everything. Just like Mark was saying, we serve those that just sometimes need a little bit of assistance, and we serve those that sometimes need a lot of assistance, like when it comes to homelessness. So we can get people that come in, and it's I like to think of sometimes Heart, Love, and Soul as a space for people to come in and have fellowship. So it's an environment where people talk to each other. They're very happy. They're very grateful for the services that we have. Sometimes I think Michael, who does our social media and our website, he does a great job at promoting Heart, Love, and Soul. But sometimes I think a big part of it is the guests promoting Heart, Love, and Soul and the services that we provide. So I would say the majority of guests have a really good experience. But then, like Mark mentioned earlier, we do have those guests that are really struggling. When it comes to the homeless piece, when it comes to their mental health, it could be substance abuse, and sometimes it could be a combination. So they come in a very tough place, having a really hard time, and we just always try to our best to meet them where they are and just place them in the right direction as far as assistance or just being that listening ear in that moment when it's needed to help calm them down and just make them realize, like, we are an agency that wants to help and that we see them. So, yeah, I think it's just a variety of experiences I think our guests have.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And I think there's so many stories that float through my mind of examples.
Feel free to share.
Yeah, yeah. Just examples of resiliency and basic goodness in people.
Yeah.
When I think about my own life and how I would respond if I was in the circumstances and situations of some of the folks that we serve, I'm not sure if I would be as gracious or as hopeful or as kind or what have you. So one of our guests, he unfortunately passed away at a very young age, had all kinds of health issues, and really relied on Heart and Soul for so much of his needs, his healthcare needs. He came to our health nurse all the time. He was there for meals almost daily. We tried to connect him to more of the help that he really needed. And unfortunately, we weren't able to connect him, in the way that we had liked, or would have wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But even in the circumstances that he had, he was continually in pain, and really you could see that he was suffering. One day he asked me for a dollar. I don't know if I should share this in front of Martha because this is against the rules, but I actually decided to give him a dollar. I trusted him that he was going to use it for what he told me, transportation. Mm-hmm. A week later or so, I saw him and he came up to me and he said, "Here's your dollar. I want to give it back." And I said, "Don't worry about it." And he said, "No, I want you to have this dollar." He said, "I don't have a lot, but at least I have my dignity."
Hmm.
And that's a story that will always resonate with me. I think it's important to remember in our sector that dignity is always there. And I think we do as much as we can to try and honor that in the services that we provide.
I hate to use the term success stories, okay? But I'm just going to, have we seen guests who've come in, they've had these circumstances, and then maybe have come back to you later and said, thanks for everything that you did, but, now I've, been able to, access this or move on to this. Have you run into circumstances like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to share one?
Yeah, one that comes to mind for me and Mark are actually talking about this yesterday. It was an older, so when I was a case manager, actually, it was an older elderly gentleman that I was working with. And when I first met him, he had told me that he was experiencing homelessness and that his family was taking advantage of his finances. Mm. So because his memory wasn't that great, so he would pay rent and then they would tell him he doesn't live here, he can't live here anymore. So then he would stay at shelters, and then when it was time to pay rent again, they would welcome him back. So it was just a lot going on with him, and it really broke my heart. But just through working with him and connecting him to the appropriate resources and our case management program, which helps guests apply for housing programs that are available through HUD, we were able to assist him and get him connected to housing. And just by providing also that kind of housing counseling, just, you know, reminding him like, hey, this is your money. You need it to take care of yourself and to pay your bills. You know, you shouldn't let people take advantage, whether it's family, friends, or whoever it is. And just by building that relationship and trust with him, and like I said, connecting him to those resources and housing programs, this elderly man was finally able to get housing and live independently. And the biggest thing for me is just not being taken advantage of. So I think it's just that to me is a huge success story, especially because I had a foot in it and helping get that assistance. But we help a decent amount of people. And I think the success stories is what we constantly just keeps us moving forward, even with the barriers and all the difficulties, especially with everything economically right now. Mm-hmm. But it just helps us keep hope, and just we help one person at a time. So it's always worth it in the end.
That was Mark Bates-Holt and Martha Lamage, the Executive Director and Program Director of Heart, Love, and Soul in Niagara Falls. We'll close out today's show with the conversation Jay Moran had with Justin Hawkins, a financial literacy educator who teaches credit strategies. The two discuss his journey from being a barber who cuts hair for the Buffalo Bills to an expert in credit education.
So what prompted you to start this?
Oh, man. Want to know the beginning is actually crazy. So I was just doing my thing. I'm a barber. I already make six figures. I cut for the Buffalo Bills. I cut the players, the coaches. And on Sundays, we go cut the fans and everything. Have you ever seen like...
It's with the signature cuts.
Yeah, right? Signature cuts. Yeah. Yep. So if you ever seen the kids with the Buffalo Bills logo on the side of their head.
See them all the time. Yeah.
So I created that apparatus to do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I created that. But so I'm just doing my thing and living life and trying to find ways to navigate, and started buying houses and stuff. And as I'm doing stuff, I'm just leaving little breadcrumbs on social media. So one day, auntie number 15 called me. So I call her auntie 15 because my wife, she always introduces me. Every week I'm meeting a new auntie. So this auntie number 15, she calls me randomly and she's like, hey, God told me that you should start a credit course. I was like, you know, I kind of felt it, but I'm like, I'm not sweating that. Kept doing what I was doing. I own vending machines. I'm a landlord. I got all this stuff going on. I'm not thinking about that, right? So 3 days before I get married, all my credit cards were shut off.
Whoa.
All my credit cards were shut off. So I looked to my wife, like, all right, maybe you can hold us, keep us afloat for in the meantime until I figure this thing out. Her credit score was terrible. She had a 580. She had six recent late payments. She had the collections I didn't know about. So I'm like, what in the world? So now I'm like, what are you doing? I'm the credit guy and your credit is terrible. What are you doing? You know what she did, right? She blamed me.
That's kind of, I've married, so I guess I understand that.
Yeah, so she blamed me. So we get married, and then I kind of just locked in. I was like, now I got to figure out my situation and figure out hers. So last year, she started the year off with a 580. Within 3 months, I had her to a 747.
747?
747 in 3 months. I said, wow. So within 3 months, I got that type of result. The next 3 months, I spent the 3 months writing a book to kind of show people the exact process I used for her credit to fix it. And I didn't remove none of the late payments. I didn't remove none of the collections. I just know how to build credit well.
Okay.
And found a way I could help everybody else do it too. So I created a little course to put together. But that's how I got here. Really just, I feel like God forced me into the, because I got that call. I kind of ignored it. And God was like, all right, you don't want to pay attention to me? All right, I'm a force you to
find a way. Yeah. So well, let's go through that in a little bit, if you don't mind talking about building your wife's credit. So you said that you did it in 3 months. That I think that's worth noting, obviously.
Right.
So what were some of the things that you did?
So first what I did was my credit is really good. So I put her under as an authorized user on one of my credit cards. It's probably like a $10,000 credit card. So that helped her with her utilization. At the time, she had two credit cards that was maxed out.
Okay.
So, but there were smaller credit cards, probably $2,000 to $2,000. Once I put her under my $10,000 credit card, that shot her stuff down. And I took over her credit, to be honest. Got all her passwords. You can't use this no more. I paid off the children's place. You know, they love to buy stuff for the kids. I paid off the children's place and cut it up. Paid off the Victoria's Secret card and cut it up. Put her under as an authorized user. I got her another credit card, a fresh credit card. You can't use this one. Then we went and got loans. So a lot of misconceptions is people get loans when they need it.
Right.
That's not actually the best way to build credit. You get loans and use them you don't have credit use you, you use credit.
So what, you're talking about getting personal loans.
Personal loans.
Okay.
So first we started with a secure loan. And with a secure loan, it's kind of like a savings account. You pay into it. Say if it's a $500 secure loan, that's what I did with her. You pay into it. And then once you paid off, then they give you $500 back. But the whole purpose of that is to build credit.
Sure. Okay.
So did
you do it through your bank, through a credit union? How'd you do it?
Credit union. Good Neighbors Credit Union. And it was simple. Just asked them, hey, can we do a credit builder account? She signed up. We did. I already had like a car under them.
Okay.
So they was familiar with me and we did it that way. That was a 6 month one. We paid that off. And then we went ahead and did a unsecured one for $1,200. Now the sneaky thing you could do is, like I said, we didn't actually need the money. We just needed to build our credit. So if you go get a personal loan for $1,200, they hand you $1,200. We use the same $1,200 to pay them back with.
Gotcha.
Because we don't actually need the money. We just want to build the credit.
Yeah.
So small stuff like that. I got her two. So the recap, I got her two credit cards. I got her two loans. That's the bare minimum you need. At all times, you need four accounts reporting. A lot of people don't know that.
Four. Okay.
Four accounts reporting. At least two got to be loans. At least two got to be credit cards. So we just took that approach. And that's what I basically came up with in my course. I'm just getting people the bare minimum, two cards and two loans. And that get them a jump start way better than what they ever knew.
So your suggestion then is first not to be in a situation like your wife, which is a situation that millions of Americans are in, right?
Yep.
We know that for sure. But you're suggesting that before you get into that situation, build your credit before you have to make those payments, right?
You got it. So the best time to build credit is when you don't actually need credit. So when you actually need it, it's already there. So if somebody unexpectedly smack your car and total it, now you got to go to the dealership and you're trying to call somebody that do credit repair to be a musician. Hey, I need everything removed by 3 o'clock today. Like, what? How is that even possible? So the best time to build credit is when you don't need it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So you've obviously been talking with your wife. So who else have you been talking with?
Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody. So I feel like it was an untapped market. Nobody, especially in Buffalo, really talks about credit. So once I got into it, my inbox is flooded. At least hundreds of people. Mostly people my age, around my age. When you get around 30, you start to care about credit. You start to realize how important it really is. You start in your family. You want to go get your first house. So mostly people around my age. But what surprised me is the 40, 50, 60-year-olds be contacting me too. And it really caught me off guard. I thought I would be talking to maybe 18 to 24.
Right.
And it's actually, I realized the problem is much bigger than I could ever imagine.
And the people that you're talking to, are the situations, the problems, are they all kind of similar?
Very similar.
Yeah?
Very similar. Very similar. So a lot of times, our community, we afraid of credit. So a lot of people say, I'm just not going to deal with credit cards at all and think that's something they can brag about. When actually, if you don't have a credit card at all, you automatically lose 165 points because you don't have utilization. So the second you get one credit card, your utilization shoots up 100 points.
Okay.
Like within the first month.
Okay.
So stuff like that, stuff like people, they 35 and only had 3-4 accounts their entire life. You need at least a minimum of 10 to even be considered fair credit.
Right.
So little stuff like that. A lot of people either have no credit cards. A lot of people don't have enough accounts reporting. A lot of people have don't do nothing with credit at all. Right. So the people with no credit at all is really the easiest to help because they don't have no bad habits to get over.
And so when it comes to some of the older folks that you're talking to, again, like you said, there's a lot of commonalities there, but it's interesting to hear that, you know, there may be people who are maybe my age who are struggling with their credit situations. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you attribute that to? That somebody could go through that portion of life and find themselves in that situation?
Fear. Our community around credit is just all fear. Even growing up, I was never taught credit. It was never talked about. But like hearing little arguments with my parents and about the credit card bill and everything, I even had fear of it. I never wanted to do anything with it until I was kind of forced into it. It intrigued me later on. I found somebody named Him500, and the way he was just talking about credit was just so crazy to me. He was saying how you could use your credit cards to make money by adding people as authorized users, how you could go buy cars and stuff and buy assets and allow the assets to pay off the credit cards. And it was like, wow, I never heard credit in this way.
Right.
And it got me intrigued in it. And I really got a head start on everybody in my generation because they don't start thinking about credit until later on.
So you use the word fear, and I certainly can remember when my credit cards are maxed out, sweating in the middle of the night,
exactly,
like nightmares. But at the same time, also, like you said, in your community, you find that people have a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fear justified in some cases? Are we seeing people being, people being repossessed,
right,
evicted, things along those lines?
So I've seen my mom's car get repossessed as well. The fear is justified, but it's only because of lack of knowledge. We fear everything we don't really understand. We fear taxes when taxes is not nothing to actually fear once you understand them. Credit is not nothing to fear once you actually understand it. You know what I'm saying? So it is justified, but maxing out credit cards, that's just bad spending habits. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So once you really understand what to do and how to do it and get strategic, and I actually do something called Strategic Sundays and really show people how to be strategic about credit. And like I said, it's not just use credit when you need it. Have an actual plan. If you're going to get a car, you don't go get a car next week. You be strategic. 6 months plan, hey, I'm going to do this, this, and that. The month before, I'm going to pay down my utilization so my score goes up. So now when I go in, I have a better score. I get a better interest rate. So we need more strategy around credit instead of fear and just being impulse buyers.
We're talking with Justin Hawkins this morning from Street Credit. Justin is helping lots of people with their credit situation. Also, we should note that Justin, if you go to see Signature Cuts, he goes under the name Juju at Signature Cuts if you want to get your hair done. But, the nice thing, of course, like you said, you found in the barbering business a nice cash flow for yourself, which was great, and it was very helpful.
For sure.
Other people, though, as you know, people who are in your community, young people in general, struggle sometimes to find jobs that really have decent paying jobs.
Yeah.
Can what you're doing here with Street Credit, can you help out somebody who's making minimum wage?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So credit isn't even about money, to be honest. So like I said, you could go get a $200 secure card, a secure loan, not even a secure card. You get a $200 secure card. You get a $200 secure loan. Maybe that payment is $15 a month. Once you paid off, they give you all the money back. I would suggest somebody just keep doing those over and over. Keep doing those over and over because it builds up your payment history. You have an amazing score, and all you're doing is recycling a $200 loan. So it's not even about money. And what I would suggest people to do, like I said, you need a minimum of two loans and two credit cards. Everybody has Netflix. Everybody has Apple Music. Get one credit card, put your Netflix subscription on this credit card, put your Apple Music subscription on this credit card, put on auto pay. Those little $30 payments is keeping your, those $30 subscription is keeping your card active so they're not going to shut it down. And then it's auto pay. So it's keeping your utilization low, which is 30% of your score. It's keeping your card active. Your score is going to shoot up. So,
and plus, you're going to be able to keep track of those subscriptions in one place instead of chasing them all over the place.
So you got to use credit. Don't let credit use you. So it doesn't take a lot of money at all, actually.
So let's talk about how you go about teaching these lessons through Street Credit. What are the possibilities for somebody who wants to know more?
Oh man, the possibilities are endless. So what I like to say is, if you understand the basics, if you want to finesse any system, you got to really understand the system at its core, the rules and regulations, and then you kind of manipulate it to work in your favor. So the possibilities are endless. As much as you, as your creativity work, you can make anything happen. And that's kind of what I do. I think of it like if you cooking. So if you go to school, they'll teach you how to cook the chicken correctly. It got to be cooked at this temperature and you don't cook it with the fish. You know what I'm saying? You wash it a certain way. And then however you season it, that's up to you. So I try to teach people to learn the basics and then get as creative as you want with it. So you can go get houses. I bought a business car. I bought a car under my business name. I only had my LLC for 3 months. I bought my first duplex with credit. I didn't have a job or a LLC at the time. My second duplex, I bought on a credit card. I use a credit card.
On a credit card.
Yep. So it's stuff like that. And
the interest rate wasn't too high?
It was zero. It was 0% interest. So
for a limited time.
For a limited time. So like I said, everything I'm strategic with. So I go get the credit card, 0% interest for 16 months. I literally just paid it off today, Jay, before I came
Congratulations.
Here.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So, you know, stuff like that. You could be very strategic once you know the basis. So, yeah, I got it. Once your credit is good enough, you could get 0% interest for the first 12 months, first 15 months, the first 20 months. If you know where to go, you know what cars to look for. You know, so everything I do is very strategic.
So what are you hearing now from the people that you've worked with? Through street credit, what are you know? Give me some besides your wife.
Yeah,
give me
some
of your success stories.
You know what? This one specifically, I like because it shows. So a lot of people, they take my help and then they go do their own thing. I really feel like they should be more attached to me and contact me before. So this specific person, I helped them with their credit. When they came to me, the highest credit card limit was $500. After about 3 months. They applied for Chase and they got a credit card and the limit was $2,500.
Okay.
So you would think, oh, that's great. That's five times higher than what they came to me as, right? But what they didn't know is if you go to Chase and you get a Sapphire card for that, just because with the same credit profile, a Sapphire card starts with a higher bottom limit. So I said, oh, that's great. But if you would apply for this card, you would have got more. So same day I had her apply for that same card, I had her apply for that card.
Mm-hmm.
She got approved for 6,000. Same credit profile, everything. Wow. So within one day, she got approved for $8,500 in credit cards. So it just showed the nuances of things. Just knowing which credit card to go with can make a big difference, and being attached to somebody that actually understands this stuff. But I get all types of stuff like, hey, Juju, you really helped me get my apartment. Hey, Juju, I got that car. I got that vehicle and my score is still going up. Thank you so much. I'm sending so many people to you. Every day my inbox is full. So many people recommended me to come to you and I hear everything.
Yeah. Now, so I appreciate how you're talking about being strategic and how you utilize your credit to help. I mean, in essence, not only help build your credit score and make capital available, but also, you know, perhaps maybe to, like you said, purchase a business-owned car or get into a duplex situation. But at the same time, what about, you know, everybody has their spending habits, right?
Right, right.
What are you telling people to, hey, stay away from when it comes to spending?
You know what? I kind of just started to develop this mindset because honestly, people going to do what they want to do.
Right.
But now I developed a 60-20-20 rule. 60% of your budget goes towards your necessities. That's your car. That's your living. That's your food. 20% goes towards fun, activities, whatever you want to do and enjoy yourself. And 20%, dang, what was the other 20%?
Save. Saving?
Save. There it goes. Save,
<good. laughs>
save investment, stocks,
right.
You know, stuff for the future, like for emergencies and stuff.
Right.
So that's what I just developed. That's actually what I just taught some kids. I was at, what is it called? Buffalo Urban League. I was at Buffalo Urban League about 2 weeks ago, and we developed that course for kids. They're about to graduate from high school and really enter into the real world. And we wanted to give them that mindset before they go out here and get their apartments or get their cars or, you know, do whatever they're about to do. I wanted them to have a budget to have in mind whenever they make money.
Now, let's go back a little bit into your personal story. Let's go back Justin Hawkins going to college, getting out of high school.
Yeah.
What kind of a spender, saver, investor were you then? Were you credit smart back then?
I wasn't credit smart. I was definitely credit ignorant, but I was always a great saver. I was a great saver, and I actually had good credit, but I wouldn't say I was credit smart. So I, okay. My dad always kind of like had the mentality of, if you owe somebody, pay them. That works for credit. That automatically works for credit. So the second, you know, if my payment due, I'm paying it. You know, just on-time payments is 35% of your score. So I always had good credit. I never had bad credit.
Okay.
But I was always a saver. I just always, when I wanted something, I wanted to have the money to have it. So yeah. That's just how I always was. Coming out of high school, I was a saver. Even when I wasn't making much, I still had money. I had money put aside. So that's just how I naturally was.
Yeah. Did you have, and you were okay with your credit cards early on? You didn't max yourself out at any time?
So I really didn't start getting credit cards until I was about 22, and I wanted to get a MacBook laptop, and I went to Best Buy and didn't even realize they gave me a credit card. I was just paying on it. So once I paid all the way off, I never even used it again. If I was credit smart, I would have went to Best Buy every month and at least made a small purchase to keep the card open. But I paid it off and never thought about it, and I let it close. And you actually don't want to let credit cards close, because one of the most valuable things you can have is an age credit card.
Oh, really?
But yeah, so started at 22. I had great credit on accident, but
okay.
I really feel like what I would say is good credit means nothing if you don't know what to do with it. Right. So I had 700 scores all the way up until I was like 26, and didn't actually start really using credit until I was 26 in a strategic way, because I didn't know until I met that one guy that was speaking about it in such a elaborate way, in an interesting way. And that's kind of what I want to do for my community. I want to speak about it in an interesting way that give people like, oh, wow, I didn't know you could do that. You know, give you that type of realization. Like, I didn't know you could do all that with credit.
Yeah, you know, and I appreciate what you say about wanting to do this for your community. I think that's, you know, obviously admirable for sure.
Yeah.
Do you see, are you getting a sense as you're starting to you know, engage people that more and more people want, you know, in the community,
for sure,
want to find a way to make this work for them, for like
sure.
You have?
For sure. And I like to be the example. Like I said, so I'm 33 years old. I bought two duplexes in 2 years. I'm not Big Bank Hank. I don't make hundreds of millions of dollars. You know what I'm saying? But I'm just strategic. So people see this and like, you know, I know him. I grew up with him. I played basketball with him. I played football with him. How is he doing this? You know, I don't sell drugs. I never did. What is this guy doing? Now let them know it's credit.
Yeah.
And it's actually simple if you just, you know, you get the foundation right, you get built on top of it. So people are very interested.
How's life as a landlord?
Life as a landlord has been good, actually. So when I bought my first duplex, I inherited my first tenant. So I bought the house with the tenant in it, and they completely trashed this place. Mm. When they finally left, the boyfriend had wrote all type of slurs on the walls, B and H. You know, because they was doing a lot of arguing. It was crazy. That first experience was really crazy. She got her kids taken by CPS. Mm. Once she moved out, the cops was coming to the house. But after that, I got a tenant with Section 8. I learned a lot about that process. And now all the payments is on time every month. We handpicked the tenant, so she was really good. I officially bought my second duplex at December 23rd of last year. So today... So now I basically have three tenants. So I like the house hack. I house hack. So the way I get low down payments, like I said, I'm strategic. I get low down payments. I get FHA loans, and which is 3.5% down. So my first, but you got to live in a house for a minimum of 1 year. So right. I house hack, bought my first duplex, got the low down payment. Went and got the second one with another low down payment, 5% down payment. So right now I have three tenants.
And you have one of the units yourself.
And I live in one. Thank you. Yep. Gotcha. And I live in one of the units myself. So today the third tenant will be paying a down payment, and they'll be moving in the first of this month. So this is my first time actually having tenants that's not on Section 8. So it'll be cool to see how they pay down everything.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And that will do it for Producer's Picks of the Week. We thank our guests, Dr. Barbara Seals-Nevergold, Lauren Costner, Tala Hardin, Mark Bateshold, Martha Lamage, and Justin Hawkins. If you missed anything or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including the full individual episodes that aired in today's compilation. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be right back.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.